This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You were just listening to Prison Focus, and the guest was TGI Justice Project. Their website is TGIGP.org. So feel free to check them out, and their email address is info@TGIJP.org. Boy, that's tough if you're dyslexic. Okay, so this is Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, Healthful Living's radio show, and I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. And I have with me today Susan Bernstein. Hello, Susan.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And Susan is she has an MBA and a master's in clinical psychology with an emphasis in somatics, and she is working on her PhD currently in somatic psychology. She has a practice called Working From Within, and it is would you call it a career development or?
I help people manage their careers from the inside out using both their intellect and their body intelligence.
Great. So where should we start with this? I just wanted to go ahead and kind of do a little bit of an introduction with kind of the type of, you know, how you came into this, you know, what your history was. I think we were both in the corporate world at one point.
Right.
And so we have a very specific view of the world, a very certain experiences of what that is like, and are able to bring that to our clientele and work with them. So I'm curious what your experience was in that world and kind of what you brought you to the work that you're doing with clients now.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the things that I discovered, one of the things that was a really pivotal event for me, and I think you and I have talked about this a little bit, but everybody else hasn't heard about this. So one of the things that was really pivotal for me was I was in management consulting for 5 years, and that was in the mid-90s. And I had an experience where I was working on a client project, and it's very common in management consulting to work 4 or 5, even more days a week out of town working for a client. So I was working for this client in Southern California, major medical company. And was flying down every single week to Southern California. And a few weeks into the project, which was a very high-stress project, not only for us as consultants, but for the company who was going through incredible turmoil in the marketplace, I was getting pretty stressed out on the project. I knew that, but I was kind of like, hey, this is a macho job. I've got to be here. I've got to be on for my client all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And on a particular Thursday night, I'd flown back into SFO, was driving home from the airport, and I got rear-ended by a drunk driver. And I didn't think it was a very major accident. I was shook up, but I could drive the car home. So I thought, oh, I'm all right. And I showed up for work the next day in the San Francisco office of my management consulting firm. And the partner in charge of the project I was on looked at me and said, you look awful. I thought I was having a bad hair day. And I'm looking at my makeup. And she said, no. You look kind of like, you know, somebody who looks like after they got hit by a car. And I said, how'd you know? And she said, well, I didn't know, but my God, go to the doctor. And I went, she said, just take the day off, go to the doctor, get in. And I did. And the doctor said, I'd like to run an MRI. I'm really concerned about you having a head injury. And I said, look, I didn't hit the windshield. I'm not doing anything like that. So for another 2 weeks, I kept going down to this client site. And each day, my headaches were getting progressively worse.
Mm.
I just phenomenal pounding sounds in my head.
Mm.
And I just thought, all right, well, this is because this project is so high stress. And I'm not only working 80 hours a week, I'm working almost 100 hours a week.
Wow.
And 2 weeks to the day after that accident, I was in a client meeting with a bunch of people around, and I passed out from the pain and went to the hospital. They said, you know, you do need to go get checked out. And it turns out that I had a pinched nerve in my neck, that I had basically had whiplash, and I had ignored all of those signals from my body. And at that point, my company asked, they told me, and the doctor told me, you have to take a month off from work. And I'm like, I'm not taking a month off from work.
Right.
I was so driven by my work instead of being passionate about my work. And in that month off, the first week I kept trying to keep working, and then I finally realized, I can't do this. I cannot keep up this crazy pace. This is not natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking into a lot of different ways to calm myself. And what I really learned is that our mind can keep chattering and chattering and chattering and telling us and driving us with these beliefs. Like, I believed I had to keep working. I had to keep up with everybody else around me.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't attuning to myself. So while that was not what, you know, it was pivotal for me, it wasn't what switched my career, it was an absolutely critical event to help me realize that I needed to take charge of listening to my body,
mm-hmm.
that I had just totally ignored all the signals. And it's sort of like, you know, if there's a set point for stress and you think of a graph and, you know, there's a line that says, don't pass this line. I was well above the line.
Right.
And I had lost touch. And what's so important to me now in my career and the way that I work with clients is not just staying in our intellect. It's so easy to live there. It is mm-hmm. so easy to live a neck up life.
Mm-hmm.
But to learn to attune to what's going on to us at a physiological level, not that we have to, you know, be a doctor and diagnose, but how do we pay attention? And that's what that's my joy in helping people to blend what they know intellectually with what they feel and sense in their lives. And I help people to create more satisfying, more energizing working lives by working with the blend of the intellect and the inner knowledge.
Do you find that a lot of people are missing that mind-body connection?
I find it's very frequent, but what's interesting is that, you know, asking simple questions like, what's happening with your breathing right now? People, they get curious about it. Like, wait, why are you asking me that? And first of all, like, you know, it didn't stop breathing. My mom loves it when I ask her. So, Mom, are you breathing right now? Do you think I stopped? I'm talking, aren't I? No, I'm not. That's not what I'm trying to say. But, you know, but simple questions like, how's your breathing? Where are your shoulders right now? If they're up near your ears, you know, we stress out. We feel it often in our shoulders, mm-hmm. our neck. That's one of the first places to find it. And people, what's been interesting to me is that it's not about your head having to tell you, put your shoulders down, but it's more about how can you actually listen in to your shoulders and know what they're needing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different orientation.
Sure. Do you find that it's a product of our culture or the work environment? I know even myself, I'm a good example of living that exact way. You know, I lived in the corporate world and for 9 years, and I remember I would drink coffee. I had totally burnt out adrenals.
Mm-hmm.
I would literally be standing in somebody's office sort of kind of jumping around.
Yes.
I don't know what I was doing, but I don't know if it was nervous energy or if I needed to keep the energy going or what it was, but I was in serious hyperdrive.
Mm-hmm.
And for years after I was out of the corporate world, you know, people would talk about being grounded and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And I thought, what's the purpose of being grounded? I didn't understand the purpose. It didn't seem to have any, I had mm-hmm. actually no desire to be grounded. In fact, I felt like I was accomplishing so
yes.
much more not being grounded. I could fly around so much faster if I wasn't grounded. So and I was addicted to the adrenaline, which I didn't understand at the
mm-hmm.
time. So now I actually can get grounded or be grounded and it feels comfortable, but it actually mm-hmm. felt uncomfortable
yes.
for a while.
Yes, I think that's very true. I would say that one of the things, I think the smaller the organization, the easier it is to stay grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a general principle that I believe. I don't know if there's research out there to support this. But I think the bigger the organization, the more people have to have some form of common goal, something that drives them together. And what that tends to be is output-related goals.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously it's profit, but we've got to get this new software to market. We have to get this new product out. We have to be able to open this new office.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so outcomes-oriented. And unfortunately, that's not the way our lives really work. We learn from the example of being so outcomes driven from our work environments that we believe that it's output that we're supposed to be about. So then there's this constant sense of, oh my God, I'm not putting something out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a deliverable, as in consulting language, deliverable. I can't deliver something to somebody. I don't have anything to show for.
Mm-hmm.
And if we start to believe that it's the tangible results of our work that is what matters.
Right.
And when we shift gears, we can come to really feel from the inside out that it's about being on the path and feeling that passion, that joy about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That it is a very different orientation but it's a much fuller orientation to life as opposed to the, oh my God, I don't get this out. And I know I worked, for example, in software. If you don't get your software release out on time, my gosh, mm-hmm. it's like the world is going to end.
Right.
It never did. But
but we felt like it would, and that's the problem, really. And if we don't have a tangible deliverable, then what I find is that people stay around the office working late at night to show that they're working hard because they don't have a deliverable to show.
Yes.
And I found that I never really liked doing that, and I never really did the, you know, long 80-hour weeks or anything. But I do know a lot of people that did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another thing, is if you're not stressed on a project, you're stressed trying to show that you're working hard. And again, you're not allowing any time for yourself, because now more and more hours are being eaten up in your career, which doesn't allow you any time for any balance or rejuvenation.
No, and the unfortunate thing is that it sets up a culture of shame. I'm ashamed mm-hmm. that I didn't work as many hours as my boss this week.
Right.
Like, what's that metric about?
Mm-hmm.
How many hours my boss worked is how I'm going to gauge my own success.
Right. Right.
Yikes. That's when we start, if we can realize from the outside that that's what we're doing, then we can start to say, hang on, maybe I need to make a change.
Mm-hmm. So you work with both individuals that are staying in their current job, helping them, as well as people that are looking for a career change.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's also about meeting somebody where they're at. If, for example, 10, 12 years ago, you would have told me I'd be doing this work that I am right now, I probably would have laughed. I would have said, how is that possible? How am I going to get there? I knew even when I finished my MBA in 1994, and even when I was deciding to apply for my MBA, I knew that what I really wanted was to study psychology. But as much as I wanted to study it, it wasn't the right time for me at that time. And do I regret having an MBA? Absolutely not. Do I regret my corporate experience? Absolutely not. Am I happy now doing psychology? Absolutely mm-hmm. I am. I've always loved that. But, you know, often I get asked by people, so I have this thing that's an avocation, a hobby that I like, and I want to make it my career, so let's go do that right now. And for very few people does it actually really work that they make that leap instantaneously. Mm-hmm. It tends to be more gradual. So, yeah, there are people for whom staying in corporate jobs and moving to a job that's more satisfying, which is, for example, what I did after that car accident I spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
I moved from serving clients to moving to an internal role. Serving the management consulting firm that I worked for and working in a more of a training and development capacity.
Right.
Which for me was much more fulfilling, much more interesting, and let me have more balance in my life. So I think it's very much about meeting people where they're at on their path. And also, I mean, I think it's also, again, attuning to the body, allowing for what organically needs to happen, really attuning to what feels right, rather than that what can happen, and very much, again, from the corporate culture teaching this, push, 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 shove, shove, shove.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we go back to human developmental patterns, babies don't come out of the womb and immediately know how to push.
Right.
We don't. We actually, babies, and I've been learning this thanks to the work of a movement practice called Bartenia Fundamentals, that babies actually first have to yield.
Huh.
You know, they allow themselves, they relax. And it's not a yielding of a passively falling down, but a, oh, how can I just kind of ooze into a new shape?
Mm-hmm.
So they first learn to yield, and then they learn to push,
huh.
and then they learn to reach,
mm-hmm.
and then they learn to pull. So we are so, our culture is very pull.
Mm.
Like, I got to have it now, I got to have it, got to
mm-hmm.
have it. And when we're in change, it can be more effective to go back to developmental patterns that we learn as infants.
Sure. I would imagine that yielding is something that doesn't fit well into most people's belief structures. It must be difficult to see that on a, you know, if someone is aware enough to realize that. But
mm-hmm.
I suppose if you can get to that point, then I'm sure you will tell us that there's lots of things that people can do to get from where they are now to start seeing some of these patterns and
mm-hmm.
realizing and changing some of them.
Mm-hmm.
What I find interesting and is if you don't believe something, you can't see the possibilities in front of you. So mm-hmm. while I completely agree that if someone wants to especially change a career, or even, like you said, change from one job to another, whatever it might be, if it feels like a big stretch to them, and now we're dealing with monetary concerns because you usually have to take some sort of pay cut in order to start something new, and that can be very stressful, and that also cannot be good for you. So there's kind of working within, you know, not having a rigid time frame or something, but kind of organically letting it grow. And that might take, I know for myself, I knew in between my second to last and my third job, that I was going to not want to be doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. So before I even got to my second to last job, I knew. And so I kind of had just these inklings, and then when that job didn't work out and I got my last job, I said, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm giving it one more shot, because it was like the dot-com time, and, mm-hmm. you know, I couldn't let it go. So I said, I'm going to give it one more shot, and I'm going to do this job, but you know what? I already know what I want to do, and I'm going to start studying now. I started taking classes so that when that job did end because of dot-com bust, I was already ready to go. Now, even then, it still took me almost a year of sort of one foot in, one foot out. Do I want to do my own thing? I don't know. This is scary. This is hard. Can I do it? You know, so even in my scenario, it was probably a several year process of thinking about it in order before I was actually able to finally step into it. So I think that what I think is important to stress to client or to listeners out there, that we're not suggesting the ideal world where, oh, just do what you love and just go out tomorrow, quit your job. But what we're saying is that if you believe it's possible, you can see a path to make it happen. You know, I have a family member who knows that the job isn't rewarding, but doesn't see anything else that could be possible. So therefore, that person isn't able to take steps or figure out what it is they might want to do, mm-hmm. because sort of there's a belief that it's not possible.
Well, I think one of the helpful things in shifting beliefs is having a community of support, mm-hmm. you know, even just finding people whose stories inspire you. So I'm constantly looking. I remember, you know, I actually wished 10 years ago when I really wanted to make a change and I was really miserable in my consulting job. I really wish that there was somebody who could sit with me and just help me understand what this transition might be like, mm-hmm. because I very much was of the belief that, I have to know what's next and I have to see that path and it has to be really, really clear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sort of the way that in the work world, I was often making work plans and, you know, this is what's going to happen 2 years out and here are all the milestones every month along the way. And our careers, and when we're making transitions, it doesn't happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
It has not been my experience that it happens that way.
Right.
Especially when we know we're dissatisfied and we're having to look around. So first it's finding people, stories that inspire, you know, reading biographies is great. Or mm-hmm. somebody, you know, you pick up whatever publication you enjoy reading. One of the things I often tell clients who are like, look, I'm just at an absolute loss, is I'll say, you know what, go into a place that has a huge stand of magazines. Go into a Borders or whatever, mm-hmm. some big, big store that has plenty of magazines. And go find two or three magazines that just catch your eye. For some reason, you want to look at them. Let that be your guide. Let the energy in your body be your guide.
Mm.
And then start to look at what articles capture your attention. And even just keep a clipping file of those things and start to go back through the images and what are the images saying to you or what are the words saying to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start to work with those as themes of things that speak to you, that somehow touch your heart or you have a gut reaction to, because those things are very real for us.
Mm-hmm.
They're really what mostly has real value for us. And we often try to get caught in the analytical trap.
Right.
What should I, you know, what is the next logical thing to do? Well, I don't really think our life is about living in a logical path. It's about living in a passionate path, a joyful path, mm-hmm. a path with energy for us. So, you know, I often work with clients who are just like, look, I'm so, and it often happens in burnout, that, you know, it's hard to know when your adrenals are shot,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't have any energy. So let the energy be really small and start with that. And start to find what speaks to you. What hobbies have you enjoyed? What kind of people do you like to hang out with when you do have free time? What do you do with that free
mm-hmm.
time? What would you most want to do with it? And start to let those themes speak to you. And it doesn't mean, again, that just because, for example, you love I don't know, stamp collecting. You're going to go out and I'm going to start a stamp collecting business and I'm going to, you know, sell stamps. And yikes, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there's something else there. So it's very much also about being in harmony with yourself and giving yourself, finding your own rhythm of change.
Right, right. I find that in that just drive to go and to, you know, we're always trying to be so logical. I think that a lot of that stems back to that in our society, science and logic and are really valued, and we're taught from a very young age to ignore anything that isn't logical. And so I think a lot of people don't even, on one level, a lot of people probably get the gut instinct thing, mm-hmm. but because they've all experienced it before,
yes.
but often the logical side even takes over then. And so I would guess that it's probably a process, I'm imagining, mm-hmm. to get somebody to be able to understand what it means to integrate the mind and the body, or to feel what it feels like in the body, or to use that gut instinct. Is that accurate?
Yeah, although a lot of us, you know, if you ask almost anybody, tell me a time where you trusted your gut and it worked. Mm. And then you ask somebody, tell me about a time where you didn't trust your gut instinct. You had it, but you said, nah, I'm not going to follow this. And then what happened?
Mm-hmm.
And you contrast those times. We often have regret when we don't follow our gut. So I've yet to meet somebody who can't talk about a time when they didn't have a gut, you know.
Right.
Everybody can talk about a time they had a gut instinct. And everybody can talk about a time when they had a gut instinct and they said, nah, I'm not going to follow this. Don't think it's right. And then they say, oh, God, what a mistake.
Right.
So there's something there. In fact, there's a story that to me is incredibly inspiring that says that even people who are incredible, well, there's two things that are very, that help me feel good about when I can go up to that logical place, take the elevator up above my neck and stay in the brain. One is a story about George Soros, the billionaire,
mm-hmm.
who is absolutely a maven. He's incredibly well gifted at being able to decide what investments to make. And he's studied investments for years, so he understands all the numbers behind it, all the logic behind it. And he's at a point of understanding that so well. I mean, sort of like, you know, when you learn to play piano, you play the scales first and then you can play jazz. He's at the jazz level.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's able to do now is he trusts his gut instinct when making investment into decisions. So I read this story about him that when he gets lower back pain, it tells him to back out of an investment. So he's looking at his portfolio and he's looking at a particular thing and lower back pain. Okay, back out.
Wow.
So here's somebody who, now I'm not saying go do that on every decision you mm-hmm. have in your life, but when you have that mastery, that expertise of a domain, then you can learn to do that. Another thing that inspires me very much about this, you know, not cheating our intellect is the most important thing, is a quote by Albert Einstein that I keep with me. Einstein said, we should take care not to make the intellect our God. It has, of course, powerful muscles, but no personality. It cannot lead. It can only serve.
Wow.
Einstein said that.
Wow.
I mean, an absolute powerhouse of a brain.
Yeah.
But even for Einstein, and Einstein, you know, in fact, I think a lot of what comes, where we develop this hyper rationality is in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a clinical internship in an elementary school, and it was really hard for me to watch kids who would squirm in their seats and teachers and me like, you have ADD.
Mm-hmm.
No, you have a lot of energy, kid.
Right.
Go for it. But we get taught to sit in our seats, so we learn to shut off what's going on in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
We don't let kids move and dance, mm-hmm. except in PE, which you might get an hour a week.
Yeah.
And so we're cutting off from that, and we're basically promoting the message that what really matters here is your intellect. And
right.
We're cutting off arts programs, my gosh, music programs, drama programs. We're telling people, we're by doing that, making those choices, we're making choices in our society about what is valuable. We're mm-hmm. telling kids that.
Absolutely. So going into that conversation about the head, I was at a meeting last night, and actually someone gave a speech on decision making, and she's very indecisive, and it's very difficult for her to make a decision. So she was doing a speech on this, and this particular book that she read was about two types of decision makers, right? There's the type that tends to eventually be satisfied with their decision, and then there's the type that wants to maximize every decision. So that's the category she's in. So with that comes that she wants to make the best possible decision. So she's analyzing and analyzing and learning. And, you know, if she's supposed to interview 3 people, she interviews 30 people. And then you can imagine what she gets. She gets analysis paralysis, yes, as I call it. Now she has so much information that if she finally makes a decision, she's still not satisfied with it, because then a month later, something new comes along, and since she knows everything she knows, she thinks, oh, I should have done that one, but it wasn't available at the time.
Right.
And so, you know, she was kind of posing the question, what do I do? Her thing is that she's trying to come up with a new career.
Mm.
And so when, like we were just talking about, it's just an unlimited possibility of what you can do. There are so many choices that it's very, very overwhelming for her.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, and I can relate to that, because I tended to live a lot of my life very analytically in my head, trying to, you know, whatever, part of my job, but also just trying to make all these decisions that way. So I can certainly feel the dilemma that she's in,
yes,
and how much stress she says that it generates.
Yes.
And on one hand, she has all of these options and all these choices, and that should give us freedom. But for her, it's just more stress-inducing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately thought of you and the show that we were going to do today. And I thought I would see, you know, as opposed to taking a caller at this very moment, we can use this as an example. Maybe you can give me a sense. I'm assuming this isn't a new example for you, and what do you suggest to people in this situation?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One is to actually, you know, if she was my client, one of the first things I would actually ask her to do is to, in some way, embody, how does it feel to have all these choices around you, to be constantly analyzing and, you know, constantly gathering more information, and not judging that in any way, but letting her feel, what does that feel like in your body? And if you could move that or express that in some way, what would that be like? And my guess is it would be pretty chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
Either it would be pretty chaotic, or it might be the opposite of that. It might be very shut down, very tight muscles, you know, very like wanting to hide from everything, pulled in tight. So in some way, it's getting in touch with, what is even that experience of making that decision doing to, and how is that acting on her own physiology?
Mm.
Because our mind and body are connected.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. We know that, you know, if we raise our hands high in the air and wiggle them around, it has a very different feeling to us than if we let our shoulders slump and we start to talk slowly. It affects our mood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this connection. So one is, I would actually give her the chance to feel what that decision-making pattern is creating for her.
Mm.
Then I would actually invite her to really think about, what is she really wanting in a career? What is deeply important to her? What is she not liking about her current work? And to really personalize it, because it sounds very much like she's depersonalizing by analyzing so much. And sometimes we do that out of the fear of, oh my God, I could be doing something I want. And the energy of that can feel overwhelming. So learning how slowly to adapt to the energy, so at a pace that's right for her, to start to, okay, what feels good to me now? What should I take in more of? And what doesn't feel good to me? And I would probably ask her to you know, show me what she's been doing with this decision. Maybe she's made a giant matrix, I don't know, some big spreadsheet or lots of things she's written down. And then to talk about that and see what happens, what shifts between choices that she has. What is she really feeling? What is she emotionally experiencing? What is she feeling in terms of tightness or looseness in her body, or warmth or cold? And just noticing her body reaction to each of those choices. And another thing that she could do in looking at those choices is to put a hand on her heart. I very often do this with clients in a very simple way. Put a hand on your heart, feel yourself breathing, look at a choice that you're considering, and tune in and slowly ask your heart, "Heart, what wisdom do you have for me now about this choice that I might make?" And then seeing what comes up. Sometimes nothing comes up. Sometimes the heart comes back with a message that you're like, "What does that mean?" Or sometimes it comes back with a, you know, a very important piece of wisdom right there in the moment. The other place to go is to the gut. Put a hand on your gut, on your belly. The, you know, Asians call that the hara, the belly brain. And there is a lot of wisdom in there. In fact, there's work by a number of researchers Gershon, who spent 25 years researching the gut,
mm-hmm.
realizing that we have more neurotransmitters in our gut than mm-hmm. anywhere else in our body. Huh, what does that mean?
Right. Well,
that neurotransmitter transmits emotional information to us. So putting a hand on the gut and saying, belly brain, my gut, what's my gut tell me about this choice I might be looking at? So that it's not so separated from our head, so that there is an emotional quality. Because if what we're really wanting to experience at work is joy and happiness and the passion of what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
that's energizing, that brings energy into our system as opposed to emptying us of energy.
Right.
So it even sounds like, you know, in many ways, she may be, just out of sheer patterns and habits and things that we learn, using techniques to make this decision that are emptying her of energy instead of helping to fill her up with energy.
Right. I've actually been doing this quite a bit lately, and I was at Burning Man, and you know, there's all these things to do. There's workshops to go to, and you know, I always love learning, so I want to go to all these workshops. And there was this fire dancing workshop, but I didn't feel like going. And when I started thinking about it, I started getting really irritated. And then I started thinking, well, I should go to that. You know that you want to go to that. And I thought, okay, what do I feel like when I think of doing that? And I feel irritated. Okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do what I want to do, which is go back to my tent. Mm-hmm. So I went back to my camp, and I opened up a book. I opened it up. I just picked a random book. I opened up to a random page. And wouldn't you know, the exact lake that we were just at the day before was mentioned in this book. And there was this whole energy thing around it. So it was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've had some, it's the more examples of that, or the more opportunities and experiences you have of that, the more that it's not, quote, coincidental anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like, oh, what a coincidence. I decided to go back and open it up to this page. No, something was telling me to do that.
And you trusted yourself there. You really trusted, you listened to yourself and not just to the chatter in our heads, which I heard you use the word should. And there's so many ways that, you know, this expression has become trite, but you should on yourself.
Right.
That we tell ourselves we should. Where is that voice coming from? Who are we really listening to? Is it friends who we feel like we have to be of value to? Is it our families, which it often has something to do with our family? Who are we so governed by, as opposed to learning to be, you know, in some ways, especially when I work with corporate types, I talk about being the CEO, our own self-CEO. Well, CEOs take information in, not just the logical information and the metrics, but they get a gut feel too. So what about trusting our own gut? What about, and you? It sounds like you finally said, hey, look, the chatter up here, I mean, mind can tell us just about anything we want it to, you know, change the dial and it'll tell you something new. But if you can listen in at a deeper level, listen to what your heart has to say to you, listen to what your gut has to say, even just listening to, you know, am I tight or loose right now? That has something to say to us.
Right.
So if we can learn to listen to that, and gradually, we don't have to do it overnight. Again, we don't have to should. I should be getting good at this by now.
Right, right.
It changes.
And we can do it with small little decisions like, what do I want to eat, or do I want to read this book? You know, we don't have to make huge life decisions
yes.
at the beginning when we're first figuring this out. Fascinating little story about maybe a year after I left the corporate world, I actually applied for this job, and it was a great, I got, the fear took over, and I got this, you know, I need money, so I was going to go back, and so there was this great job, and I got all the way to the vice president, and then someone told me, oh, well, once you get to the vice president, the job is pretty much yours. So I have an interview with the vice president, and then I find out later that I didn't get the job. And I kept telling myself, you know, I'm just going to let the universe decide. And then I thought the universe wasn't going to decide for me, because it was going to make me decide.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know, if the universe would just decide for me, I'll be fine with whatever the decision is. So it ends up that I don't get the job, and I asked the guy why I didn't get the job. He said, you know, I'm not really sure. I feel like I should, you know, you're qualified and everything, but something's just telling me, you know, that this job isn't right for you. And I thought, you know, and I left there, you know, here I am supposedly rejected, smiling and laughing to myself, going, ah, the universe made this decision. He trusted his gut, and his gut was right. And so, you know, it was sort of, you know, it felt like it was working against me, but it wasn't. It was working mm-hmm. in everybody's favor because mm-hmm. it was helping him and his company, and it was helping me with my decision. So I thought that was fascinating.
Well, we also, you know, if you met with him in person, or even if you just talked to him on the phone, you know, we resonate with each other. We can pick up on each other's vibes.
Mm-hmm.
So it may have been that something was telling him that, you know, some neurotransmitter, some chemical in your body is basically shouting out this message.
Right.
I really want this.
Right.
And his body is going, I don't know what this data means, but it's not, it's, you know, something's not resonating here.
Yeah.
And that we feel when we're in resonance and we're out of resonance with people.
One of the challenges that I have, and I'm guessing your clients might also, is I can do that like we just talked about, but then there are certain decisions that are really big and fear is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then when fear is involved, I have a really difficult time determining, is my feeling that I'm feeling an intuition telling me not to do it, or is it fear that's stuck in the way that once I can remove that, then I can make the proper decision. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest to somebody where...
Yeah. So one of the really important dimensions then is to know how fear manifests in your own body. So that you know, you will know physiologically, is this fear or is this intuition? So mm-hmm. part of it is, like we talked about just earlier, you mentioned, you know, smaller decisions. In a smaller decision, what does fear do to you? Does fear, for example, make your shoulders tight? Does it make your belly tight? Does it make, for me, I know my upper arms get tight. Can't tell you why.
Hmm.
You know, I get tight between what my biceps and triceps just conquer down. And that's for me where fear is there, and sometimes in the middle of my chest. So that's how I know that I have fear. And then intuitions show up for me somewhere else. Hmm. Intuitions usually show up for me somewhere around my solar plexus. Often, I don't know why, they happen in my neck. I'll get like, oh, my neck just feels more loose. Okay. So that can be a set of cues, is listening into your body. And also one of the things that I've learned to do for myself and I teach my clients to do is to be able to talk with the fear. If you know that it is fear, mm-hmm. is there's a higher self that knows that, yeah, fear is real, and being able to say, hey, I know you feel this fear and I'm wondering what you're needing.
Mm.
So that you're having a dialogue with that fear so that the fear is acknowledged.
Right.
And sometimes even feeling it more, even magnifying that fear, especially in the body. And what happens when I play with it? You know, I let myself kind of experiment a little, almost like a radio dial.
Mm-hmm.
Dial up a little bit more of that physiological feeling of the fear and dial it down a little. So I'm like, oh, it's just a feeling. It's just a sensation. And one of the principles in somatic psychology, and I believe this comes from core energetics or bioenergetics, is the idea that fear is excitement without the breath.
Hmm.
So when we're fearful, we're probably actually really underneath excited, but we're not letting ourselves breathe freely.
Wow,
you know,
that's
that
interesting.
We've tensed up, and when we're only using when we cut off our oxygen supply, and I don't mean that we, you know, hold our nose, but when we're only breathing shallowly, it means we're not getting enough oxygen to the brain, and when the brain's deprived of oxygen, we can't make as good a decision. So one of the ways to deal with fear is to learn to breathe into it. You can even imagine the fear and imagine it, you know, getting big and breathing into that big fear until it's so big it's just dissipating out. You know, kind of the way that when you put a drop of food coloring in a glass of water, it dissipates out.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's, yeah, that really... it seems a little counterintuitive. Most people, when they're afraid, they want to constrict and
yes.
try to ignore it and not think about it.
Yes.
So this is a very, something I would guess you'd have to have some awareness at the beginning
yes.
to.
And it helps to have somebody, you know, guide you through that so
sure.
that you're not alone going, now I'm getting more
that,
fearful.
That you're never going to come out of it.
Right.
So in the last few minutes, I'm curious if there's anything that you want to mention. I know I know you're doing a lot of studies. I don't know mm-hmm. if you want to go into some of the research or anecdotal things or a client example or, you know, I'm open to whatever.
Ah, wow. Okay, I'll give you the choice. I have a client example I can share with you about somebody who actually using body awareness helped to make a shift, or just sharing some information about gut and heart and body awareness and the real research that shows that can be very valuable. So I'll toss that back to you. And
well, let's do the client example, because I think that people can relate to that.
Yeah, sure. So this is a particular client experience that I've shared with a number of people, and it somehow it seems to resonate. So I had a client who came to me feeling extremely stuck. Very, very incredibly bright man. He has a PhD, and I'm not gonna give anything that's too revealing. It's not my style to do that. I keep all my client information's kept confidential. But incredibly brilliant person, well versed in math and physics and all the natural sciences. And had been at a job for about 7 years. He'd been in a company for 7 years, and for the last two was very upset, very miserable with the work. And to try and get out of just doing the technical piece of his work, he went and got an MBA. So he was getting more into management, but his last 2 years, he was just miserable. And he said to me, "Susan, I'm so stuck." He said, "For the last 2 years, I have been sending resumes and writing cover letters and making phone calls to people. But it's been this choppy, I'm so stuck, and it's such a choppy process of sending a resume and sending a cover letter, and nothing's happening. I'm stuck. I need your help." So what I asked him to do was actually to stand up and to use his body and show me what it felt like to be choppy and stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So he stands up, and it was like watching somebody do karate. One hand out, chop! I send a cover letter. Another hand chops out to the side, and I send a resume. Chop! I make a phone call. And he starts doing this for a while, and he says, "Do you see what's happening?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm not going anywhere." He's standing with his feet planted in place, doing karate in place with this phone call resume. And so then I said, "So with your body, and not asking your mind to get involved, but with your body, show me how you'd like this job search and this change, what you'd like it to feel like." So he stands in place for a while, and he closes his eyes, and he's still in place, and he's kind of moving his hips back and forth very gradually. And then he picks up one foot slowly, 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 like it's in molasses, and puts it down, and then the other foot, and then back and forth. And all of a sudden, he's sort of gliding, and he starts moving around, and no longer in place. And it's almost like watching somebody slowly dance through molasses. And he starts laughing. He says, "I'm dancing. I want my wife." And I said, "You want your wife?" He says, "My wife hasn't seen me dance in years." So he's moving around, and he's moving more and more. His hips are moving more, and his arms are moving more. And of course, I have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. I'm just watching. I'm simply watching. And he's laughing, and he looks at me, and he stops, and he looks at me. He says, "Susan, I get it." "What?" I said. He said, "You know, I had been standing in place thinking that all my security came from being in place. But as I dance, I realize that my safety," and he's rubbing his legs as he says this. He says, "My safety and my security is within me. It's not from this job. It's not from staying in place." He had been stuck for quite some time. I mean, 2 years of sending out resumes and cover letters and not getting anywhere. And when we started working together more, I mean, he realized, and he started shifting and started moving towards work he really loved. But that realization, I really don't think would have happened quickly through any form of talk work.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been to see other career coaches. And what I think was unique is this bringing him into his body. And here's somebody who's very, very, very heady. An intellectual. Mm-hmm. I think he said that about himself. So, you know, and there's often a joy. I think there's often a greater joy in people who are in their heads so much coming into their bodies. It's like, "Oh, you mean I have this whole other resource available to me?"
Mm-hmm.
So there's a joy that comes with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a great example. I think just a good point for everybody out there. If you feel stuck, like you've analyzed the situation to death and you know all the nuances, you know the causes and the triggers and this and that, but you can't make a change, then this type of work, this mind-body work, can be really helpful, because many of us, including myself, have analyzed things over and over and could tell you everything about the problem, yet for what, quote, whatever reason, we're stuck. We can't get out of that. Mm-hmm. And so this allows us a different resource than just thinking about it more.
Yes, exactly.
Well, this has been really great. I wanted to give you a moment. I know you have a teleconference and a website, and I'd love for you to share that.
So my company name is Work From Within, and my website is workfromwithin.com, just like it sounds, Work From Within, no underscores, no dots, just workfromwithin.com. And I'd love to invite your listeners to join me. I have a free teleconference coming up next Friday, the 30th of September. It'll be from 12 to 1 p.m. And the topic of that teleconference is how to create work that really matters to you, how to go through this journey, what you need along the way, issues about money, issues about support, issues about trying to decide what's next. So if you go on my website and you click on teleclasses or events, you'll be able to see there's a link and you just sign up through email, and I'll email you the details so that you can join. It's totally free. The only cost is any cost of dialing the number to dial in, but there's no charge for this class. It's really my passion, and my joy in life is connecting with other people and helping them to find what really matters, finding satisfying, energizing, working lives. So I'd love to welcome your listeners to that. And there's also all kinds of resources and articles and links on my website if you're interested more in the mind-body connection, or particularly if you're interested in how this relates to your career. I'd love you to take a look.
Great. Yeah. Susan Bernstein, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. My website is healthfullivingsf.com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon for Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. We will speak with you or hear from you, hopefully, next Thursday. Thanks so much.